Yeah, thank you, everyone. So ordinarily, this is where, so I'm Ilya. My slides are called Introduction to Causal Inference. Consequently, if you work in causal inference, you will be bored by them, and I'm sorry. So ordinarily, I should thank the organizers, but I can't do that because this is a blatant case of nepotism. I was an organizer, and I'm giving this talk, basically. So no thanks to me. So there are lots of introductions to causal inference one could give. The purpose of this whole thing that Ellie, Rob, and I are doing is to build bridges between the quantum foundations community and the causal community because they've been developing in parallel for a while. And usually if bridges are built when that happens, then good things tend to happen. I think Rob mentioned that in his talk as well. So I'm going to try to do it with an eye to that. So what will I actually cover? There will be a few ideas in this talk. One of them is a distinction between a causal DAG and a statistical DAG. They're not the same. They're often confused. There was allusion to this distinction in earlier discussions, both at lunch and before that in questions. So I think that's an important idea to get across. And I think it informs a lot of other things. I had a very nice discussion with Rob about causal parameterizations versus statistical ones and various issues with that. Another important idea is, people like Pearl like to say that graphical models are super great for representing causality, and they're right about that. They absolutely are great. But there isn't like the causal model for a DAG or for a graph. For a given graph, there are many causal models, and I think that's another important point. And the distinctions between these models potentially become important, and we'll maybe get into that later. And I'll talk a little bit about hidden variables in causal inference, because this workshop is about hidden variables, and hidden variables create complicated problems for causal people who do stuff with data. One of the things I will sprinkle throughout is nomenclature notes and discussion and glossary stuff. And I think that's because I've learned not too long ago at Simons that people in quantum foundations have names for things that we have different names for. And I think it would be good to just put out some names for things and describe them, and then maybe that will spur some discussion later. There's going to be some basic stuff here, and I apologize for that. So statisticians use the word model a lot. So we've talked about this. I've talked about this with physicists, and they don't necessarily like this nomenclature, although Rob is kind of using it now. So a statistician, a statistical model, is a set of distributions on a set of random variables or in a sample space. So that's just what it means to them. So for example, if you take a machine learning class, the first thing they will teach you is like a linear regression predictor model. You have an outcome and a set of features, and it's you think that the outcome has a linear relationship of a set of features up to some noise term, usually Gaussian in this case, but not necessarily. So a statistical model formally to a statistician is any distribution that satisfies this kind of relationship, basically. And I know that in talking to Ellie that in physics, this is not how people use the word model, and that's fine, obviously. Like in model theory, people don't use the word model like this either, which we'll get to later, actually, because I think it's going to be an important distinction. But I think, this is like if you want to talk to statisticians, that's kind of what they mean. And certainly when you read papers, it's important to keep this stuff in mind. So we're going to talk about directed acyclic graphs. This is probably too basic for this audience. So a DAG is a certain kind of directed graph that doesn't allow cycles. Here's a positive example of a DAG. There is an undirected cycle. So cycle if you ignore edge orientations, but there isn't a directed cycle. Whereas the example below, there is a directed cycle, and that's not allowed because that for graphical models that complicates various things we want to do. So in graphs, we talk about relationships between vertices using genealogy metaphor that may have come from Sewell Wright's work. I actually am not sure, because Sewell Wright, as Stefan was saying, was talking about pedigree analysis, like sires, dames, and the animal children of them. So in a graph, again, this is just review. In the graph above, A is a parent of B, for example, and B is a child of A, because there is an arrow from A to B. And similarly, A is an ancestor of E, and E is a descendant of A. And by convention, just to do the base case right, a variable is its own ancestor and descendant. We'll use these kinds of notation, so you'll see this in the literature as well. So a graphical model just associates vertices in a graph with variables. So in fact, if people aren't careful, so they just use the same letter for both a vertex and a variable, even though that's technically a type error. And there are three equivalent definitions. There is a very clear discussion of this in Stefan's book about why they're equivalent. So equivalent ways of defining a set of distributions. So in other words, one way is to say a statistical model of a DAG is any distribution that you can write according to this formula here, where you have a product of terms. Each term is a variable given its parent, so it's a bunch of conditional distributions. Another way is the local property, which is a small list of conditional independences that implies logically all the other independences that hold in the model. And then there is the global Markov property, which lists all independence constraints in the model, and usually it's a big list. And as luck would have it, the nice thing about graphical models is they allow you to implicitly represent the list by a graph separation or a path separation criterion, where you basically say a set of variables is separated from another given a third if some statement on paths connecting these sets holds, like paths are blocked or not blocked. And that implies some sort of independence. I'm not going to describe this criterion because it will take too long, but it's deseparation, basically, and if you've seen it, great. Sometimes DAG models are called Bayesian network models. I think that's name is due to Perl. I'm not actually sure. I feel like that's the kind of, I think he came up with that, right?
I think so. And I think the reason was really to, in contrast with neural networks, it was in connection with AI.
I see.
Neural networks, which essentially reasoning forward, whereas Bayesian networks inverted the reasoning by using Bayes formula.
Right, so you can, right, that's right. So you could compute by abduction, I guess he called it. You could compute a probability of a variable given its children or its descendants by just being clever using Bayes' rule, essentially. Although, of course, neural networks are graphical models, so I don't know if that insight kind of survived to this day.
It was really the way you used them that way.
Yeah. Right, that's right. So they were just forward predictors. That's right. I don't actually think it's such a great name anymore. Because there are so many different statistical models of a graph now. Okay, so here's an example of a DAG factorization. Again, this is all pretty straightforward. The local Markov property is a small list of independences that imply the rest. And for a DAG, this is every variable is independent of its non-parental non-descendants given its parents. That's one way of getting this model from just the chain rule representation of a joint distribution. You could write down the chain rule in the ordering that's sort of consistent with this graph, also called the topological ordering, where variables, ancestors come before descendants, basically. So if you do that, you just have a chain rule where it's a variable given stuff earlier in the ordering. And then what you can do is you could consult this independence and drop some terms from the factorization. So this way, kind of the local Markov property and the factorization are closely connected. So you could get the factorization from this very easily. Okay. So one thing I will mention is, since we're talking about Markov properties, which is independences that are implied by the model, we can have two DAGs that are structurally different, but that imply the same model. So this is a very simple graph, and you could see that A is independent of C given B in this graph according to the local Markov property for both of them, because A is a non-parental non-descendant of C, and it's and B is a parent. This is the only independence in this model because it's not that complicated. And so this actually has two implications for us. One of them is that people like to ascribe a causal interpretation to DAGs, and you have to be a little bit careful with that, because if all the DAG is telling you is some independence facts in the observed data distribution, and there are two of them, and they disagree on orientation of edges, then we have a problem, because they can't both be causally correct. Only one of them at most can be causally correct. So we have to keep it clear. So this is one sort of reason to keep causal and statistical notions distinct. So there were some discussions on Slack about what do edges mean. And in some sense, in a statistical Markov model, edges don't mean anything. Absences of edges mean something. And what they mean is just whatever the Markov property says they mean. It's just an abstract game you play. And so it's very tempting to kind of ascribe meaning to this beyond that. And I think it's kind of important not to do that, because sometimes you get into problems. Now, we'll talk about causal graphs in just a second, so where you will have meaning. Okay, so that's problem number one. Problem number two is that it's the same model. So if we're going to do model selection, so model selection is the task of looking at data and deciding what graph we like better, that better represents the data that we see. So which is related to causal compatibility, which is what a lot of folks in the audience in the physics end potentially worry about. It's pretty clear that because both of these DAGs imply the same thing on the observed data, they're equally compatible with the data that we might see, if it so happens that this independence holds in this data. So we can only learn things up to equivalence classes if we're going to use conditional independences. And more generally, if you're worried about using inequalities to falsify, that's another thing to worry about, because it could be that two structurally different DAGs imply the same inequalities, which implies that you can only falsify them or not together. You have to think of them as a set. Okay, so these kinds of equivalent up to some constraints we know is an important idea in model selection. And it kind of complicates our life. Okay, and I think Robin's talk mentioned that as well. I think he was talking about equivalence of mags as well, because he was trying to select among mags. Okay, this observational equivalence is an issue and is going to create problems for us. Okay, I should just mention briefly, this is just a very brief review of statistical inference. Sorry, it's a bunch of text. So this is one way to think about it, which is, I guess, more of a frequentist view. I have a model. So my model is a set of distributions in a sample space. I think one of them is the true one. And I want to learn some parameters of the true one. And usually the way you think about this problem is nature generated a bunch of samples from us from this distribution. They're independent, identically distributed. And we want to learn this parameter by guessing what it should be based on data. And then statistical inference is just how do we construct this guess in a good way, basically. And this is a very generic description, so lots of problems can be formulated in this way, including problems you might care about, such as predictive modeling and parameter estimation, image analysis, text and speech processing, model selection problems. If you're interested in figuring out what your bounds actually are from data, something Rob and I were discussing with some folks earlier, that's also this problem, because those bounds tend to have a polytope form, like it's a max of some stuff, which are functions of the data. So those things have to be estimated. And then there are certain problems with how to do that well. Okay. So one way to do it is to do statistical inference is to do the likelihood function, which is just if I have independent and identically distributed samples, then it's just what's the probability of seeing the data that I see according to some parameters we guess. So you can think of the likelihood as a function of the parameters. And then what you do is you pick a parameter to maximize this likelihood or alternatively minimize the surprise of seeing the data that you see. And then you just figure out your target parameter by just plugging in those estimates. So that's called the plug-in principle. There are lots of other approaches, of course. Sometimes you don't have a good likelihood specification. So you in machine learning, sometimes you minimize a loss. And the loss you minimize is tailored to the application. Maybe you want to generalize well, so you impose some regularization on the loss and all sorts of things like that. Sometimes in semi-parametric statistics, you solve an estimating equation because that's easier than maximizing likelihood. So it's some equation that's mean zero at the truth, and you use that to pick what the parameters should be. And a lot of sort of statistical side of causal inference is thinking about these kinds of problems for complicated things that correspond to causal effects, basically. Okay, so that's statistics. So let's talk about causal models. This was already described, I think, or alluded to earlier. There are two approaches, at least two. There's more, but two I'll talk about here to thinking about causality, the random variable approach and the causal mechanism approach. The random variable approach arguably goes back at least to Neyman, probably even before Neyman, because Neyman distinguished potential outcomes from actually observed outcomes in his thesis. Neyman kind of got extended by way of Dan Rubin and company, who started thinking about the Rubin causal model using essentially that idea. But really, Jerzy Neyman's approach really goes back to Hume's counterfactual definition of causality and events. Like, an event followed by another, is caused by it. If the prior event didn't occur, hypothetically, the subsequent event never would have happened, something like that. I don't remember the exact quote, but he has this counterfactual definition, which is very similar. Okay, and the causal mechanism approach, I guess, originated with Sewell Wright, because Sewell Wright was specifying these linear pedigree analysis models. And he was effectively, because he was thinking of genetics, the parents in his graph were literally parents biologically. So this was clearly a causal relationship of genomes. That went by way of econometrics and social science and kind of became graphical models through Stefan and Pearl and SGS. In the first approach, the random variable that's a hypothetical outcome of something is primary. And in the second approach, the graph and the causal mechanism is primary. But the point is, they're kind of very connected and describe essentially the same structure. They just choose to emphasize different things with different notation. And I think that's what's important to understand. OK. So let's talk. I'll talk about them both briefly. So a potential outcome or a counterfactual, although some people make a distinction between these, like Phil David does. So why parentheses A? So sometimes there is lots of notation for this. So I use parentheses. If you read Pearl, like in his book, sometimes it's a superscript, and sometimes it's a subscript, and sometimes it's something else. Sometimes it's given do A, which is fine. I mean, multiple notations are fine, but just keep in mind that there is not a single agreed upon notation. So what this means is the outcome of Y, if A were set possibly contrary to fact to value A. That's the magical incantation for this. So in other words, I'm a coffee drinker. I, in fact, had some coffee this morning because I wanted to give this talk and not fall asleep. And I do not currently have a headache. And a potential outcome could be what would be the status of my headache if possibly contrary to fact I did not have coffee this morning. So those kinds of things. OK, and the thing to understand about why parentheses A is it's a random variable. And therefore, I can apply anything I can do to random variables to this guy, even though it doesn't really exist. It's magical make-believe random variable. And so one way to think about causal models is causal models are statistical models and counterfactual variables with some properties. So it's a set of distributions over these weird variables with parentheses in them. And so there are lots of ways to do it. And in fact, one of the big arguments in our community is should we use graphs to think about models like that or not? And Pearl certainly is an advocate of graphs. And some people don't like graphs so much for various reasons. I'm going to talk about graphs in this talk for the most part. In such a model of a graph, of a DAG specifically, directed edges somehow represent a direct causal relationship. And I'm going to try to say a little bit about what that means. And in fact, people cash out what that means in different ways. So it's going to go back to the fact that there are many causal models you can talk about. OK, so this is going to follow the single world intervention graph paper or the SWIC paper. I see it. And so you could read more of it there. It's kind of a book-sized paper. It's 120 pages, I think, or more. Go ahead, Murat.
Yeah, so I have a question about notation or even the representation. In potential outcomes, how do people distinguish a conditional interventional query from a counterfactual query?
Conditional intervention, what do you mean?
So conditional distribution and interventional distribution versus counterfactual. Apparently it's a distinction, right? So I'm just curious how it's represented in the...
You're talking about the hierarchy or something? Like Pearl's hierarchy? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, like for example, I mean, in DAG language, right? P of y sub x given x prime is a counterfactual, right? So...
Yes. So I... Go ahead.
P of y given do x comma... Z would be rank 2.
I think you are talking about the latter.
Yeah, yeah. So those two, he makes a distinction, right?
Yes.
How would I make a distinction? How do they make a distinction in potential outcomes?
So sometimes people say, so there is this thing called the ladder of causation, which I'm not going to get into, which basically distinguishes between outcomes of interventions and things that talk about multiple counterfactuals that potentially correspond to different interventions, or something like that. So I'm actually going to talk a little bit about that later. But the point is, on the level of a single variable, there is no such distinction. If you start talking about joints of things, then there is such a distinction.
Oh, I see.
And we can get into that later. So again, this follows the SWIG paper. I highly recommend reading the SWIG paper because it connects two formalisms, or tries to. So the purpose of this workshop is to build bridges between physics and causal inference. The purpose of the SWIG paper is to build bridges between the graphical model's view of causality and the potential outcome's view of causality. So it's similar in spirit. And also, I think it's a good paper, although they're pretty mean to Pearl in it, which I think possibly unfairly so. But nevertheless, it's a very good paper. And I followed their presentation almost exactly here. OK, so we're going to start with a DAG, and we're going to think of a bunch of variables in this DAG. And we're going to assume that for every variable, a counterfactual exists, where you set all the parents of that variable in a graph to some value for all possible such values. So those things are assumed to exist. They're like basic building blocks, basic building block counterfactual random variables from which we will build everything else. So for example, in this graph, there are these variables that are assumed to exist if everything is binary, just for simplicity's sake. Okay, and remember that roughly speaking, parents of a variable are its direct causes. And the way that this is cached out in this view is that to specify a model, I need to tell you how a variable varies if I intervene on its direct causes. That's like the basic building block I need. I'm going to put everything together from that. Okay. Great. So then we'll need to define other counterfactuals. And these are called one step ahead sometimes, or just atomic ones. And we'll construct the other ones by just what's called recursive substitution, which just substitutes in counterfactuals we know we have to get the counterfactuals we need. So for example, if I want to know what would be the value of the counterfactual y, if I were to intervene on A, what I do is I know what y would be if I substituted A and C. So I substitute the A that I want it to be, little a, and I substitute C to any random variable it likes. So in other words, one way to think about it is I draw a random sample from C, and whatever it comes out to, I stick it in there. Okay. So you can see that the left-hand side gives me a counterfactual where only A is intervened on, and the right-hand side contains a counterfactual of Y of A and C, and C, which happens to be an observed variable because there is no parenthesis for it. So these things on the right-hand side are already assumed to exist, and I put them together in this way to give me another counterfactual. And here is another one that I just like, I can define. Again, here I recursively substitute A that is itself a counterfactual that responds to C. Okay.
Is this a definition or this is a theorem?
This is a definition. This is, so when I say, so in this way of thinking, while away means, the left-hand side means the right-hand side. It's just a shorthand notation for that.
But then, when you define the counterfactual, you assume y subset, subset any set exists. But then now you are trying to connect them. How do I know how they connect to each other in general?
Not sure I'm following your question. So I am assuming, look, let's just talk about this first case. I am assuming y of little a, little c exists for any little a, little c. And I am assuming c exists. Okay. So essentially, I have a so I'm going to tell you what a machine is for getting a sample of y of little a. And that machine is going to go like this. First, I sample from C. Then whatever sample I see, whatever value I see, I put it in to the little c slot for y of a and c.
So and that's for this specific graph?
Well, it's a general definition. I'm just using this graph as an example. So the general definition is this one, but it's like this annoying recursive formula, so I didn't want to get into it. But basically what you do is you look at the to define a counterfactual, you know, V of A, what you do is you look at A. If any of the A are the parents of V already, I just put them in at those values. And if any and for all the other parents, I just recursively substitute the counterfactuals for those parents in there, in those slots. And that's why it's called recursive substitution, because then I have to do those guys recursively with the same definition. And the reason the definition terminates is because the DAG is acyclic. So I recursed, but I moved one level up in the graph. So eventually I'm going to get to the point where there are no parents anymore.
So this is respect to a particular graph.
Yes, yes,
graph,
that's right.
You have this kind of relationship.
Yes, that's right. So there is the parents of G here. So this has to be with respect to that G. That's right. Yeah, I start with a specific DAG. That's right. Thanks, Jin. Okay. Good. So one of the so recursive substitution hides a lot of stuff in it, actually. So one of the things it hides is what's called causal irrelevance, which is that because my graph might have some missing edges, it might be that some of my counterfactuals don't depend on some interventions that took place. So here is our good friend, the instrumental variable graph, where for simplicity, I'm assuming the unobserved variable is actually observed. And if I define the counterfactual y of little a, little z with this definition in the previous slide, I will find that it's equal to this. And you will see that because it's equal to this, it doesn't mention z anywhere. And consequently, it's not a function of z. So this is called an exclusion restriction sometimes. And this is an important thing that comes up in falsifying IV, of course. And again, this is things in red tend to be like glossary terms. So we can maybe revisit those later. So in causal, these are called exclusion restrictions. I think this, I'm not sure if this is from econometrics or not originally. Anyways, there are other interpretations of this constraint. But I think in this presentation, it's assumed that this is just, it holds for everybody, basically. It is the case that if I look at any person, their corresponding counterfactual will not depend on z. And there are other ways to think about it. The other implication of this is what's called consistency. And consistency says that if I observe something to be the case, if I happen to observe something to be the case, whether I intervene on that or not doesn't matter. So that the responses are the same. So for example, in the above graph, if it so happens that I observe that a is little a, then the observed y and the potential outcome y, if I were to intervene a to be little a, are in fact the same thing. For example, it so happened that I had coffee this morning. Consequently, my observed headache status, which is no headache, everything's great, and my counterfactual status of my headache, had I had coffee, hypothetically, are the same thing. So that's an assumption. You don't have for that to be true. The way this would be violated is if something about the way you do an intervention changes something. So one way to think about what consistency is saying is it's like invariance of causal mechanisms. There is some biochemical mechanism that maps whether I have coffee or not to whether I have headache or not. And this mechanism doesn't care whether I drank coffee of my own free will or whether somebody forced me to drink coffee, making it an intervention. It just like operates anyways, right? Which is why, you know, if I happen to drink coffee of my own free will, so I observe a is little a, I get coffee, and then if somebody like opened my mouth and just like stuck it in there, it would also have the same outcome. So my biochemistry doesn't care. But the point is, this isn't always true. You could imagine situations where a natural outcome, the causal mechanism would behave one way, but if you try to intervene in this outcome, intervene in some variable, the causal mechanism somehow reacts to that in unforeseen ways. So sometimes these are called fat hand interventions. So for example, if I want to make an intervention in a cell, cells are small and they're big and clumsy, and if I want to change some protein expression or something, I don't know what people do, or knock out a gene, like it may be that it will have unforeseen consequences. And consequently, the fact that I intervened changes the way things respond. So that would be one way in which consistency could fail. Okay, so another way of thinking about consistency is it's a causal mechanism invariance or indifference to how variables are set. Yeah?
Can you allow the variables that you're conditioning on the lowercase ones, do you allow those to be random variables as opposed to just specific values?
So the convention I tried to use, I hope I'm consistent with this, is that capital letters are random variables, lowercase letters are values of those variables.
Yeah, so the reason I ask is, so in the definition of consistency, you've got capital W equaling lower W.
Yeah.
It can happen sometimes if capital W is a...
Yeah, it's an event. It's an event.
Right, but in general, capital W is a random variable, so this can, I mean...
I just mean, sorry, when I say random variable equals value, I just mean that event took place. Or I'm conditioning on that event.
Yeah. But if conditioning W on A just leads W to still be stochastic, then you can't have this consistency kind of relation. Right?
I'm talking about regular conditionalization and probability theory. Like, I have a coin and I flip it and it comes up heads. And now, like, I'm saying the random variable coin is equal to heads. That's the sense I mean. There are more refined notion of interventions people consider in the literature, so-called soft interventions, and we can talk about that offline, but sure. That's not part of the basic thing I'm trying to run through. And you're right, that might affect this, potentially. And in fact, people study consistency violations. At the American Causal Inference Conference, which is going to be in May, down in Texas, I think there's a whole session on this, actually. Yeah. Okay. Good. And sometimes people think of consistency as coarsening. So the way to think about it is, this is the potential outcome view again. Like, every person has two ghostly potential outcomes about their headache and coffee status or something that float behind their heads. And then on the basis of what kind of treatment they see, coffee or no coffee, one of them becomes real. So they write it as this sum sometimes. OK. And yeah, so another way to think about causal inferences is a missing data problem. And there is a big literature in statistics, of course, on missing data that's quite good to read. They have lots of cool ideas. Okay, so let's think about a generic causal model of a DAG. So a model is a set of distributions. We have a set of one set of head counterfactuals. So we can just think of all distributions that over all the variables we've defined, which is one step ahead, and these other ones that we've defined artificially by this recursive substitution thing, and just put them in a big bag and just think about the joint over that. And so that, if I just say that and I say nothing else, that's something like the nonparametric structural equation model or something like the structural causal model. So by itself, it doesn't encode very much. It encodes consistency, and it maybe encodes exclusion restrictions. And that's about it. So you could think about it as in this example as just all distributions that obey consistency, essentially. And consistency is going to be implied by recursive substitution.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is someone in Zoom that had their hand.
Yeah. No, yeah, it's me. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I just raised
absolutely.
My hand.
Absolutely. Go
ahead. So my question is about those recursive variables that you defined, and you said that they're in this that slide. The slide you were before was great, because my question is, when you consider all of those variables, is this equivalent to considering only, well, the observed probability distributions that you had access to, and the conditional do conditionals of those?
Yeah. So this is kind of
your parents.
So this is definitely, so these things right here are observed because they only have capital letters inside the parentheses, and basically by consistency is just observed Y, observed A, observed C. But all these things here are not observed, of course. And in fact, in general, when I have marginal distributions of this joint, that's going to be what Murat's referring to as counterfactual, like what Perl calls counterfactuals, meaning that there is no, like this includes everything. So this potentially includes a variable where A is set to one thing and another variable where A is set to another thing. And it's perfectly meaningful to consider that margin for something. And in fact, people have considered margins like that for various things, like probability of necessity or something. But we'll get to that. Right now, I'm just talking about the whole model. Like the model is like the joint over everything, all everything you have. Like all the things that are observed and all the things that are counterfactual, that are definable. So that's just the statistician view. It's a set of distributions. It's just a big set, or a set of over a big set of variables. Okay. So again, by itself, the NPSEM or the structural causal model won't give you what you want. So what is it that we want? So in classical statistics, we have an observed data distribution, and we have some parameter that we want to learn from it given samples. And this parameter could be complicated. It could be like a very big predictive model like they have in machine learning. The parameter could be infinite dimensional, of course. So the difference in causal inference is that it's the kind of statistics where we still have observed data typically, not always, but our parameter is counterfactual. So for example, we might be interested in this kind of expectation where it's the expectation of the random variable y if I were to intervene a and little a. Okay. Why would we care about these parameters? Because in causal inference, we conceptualize causal effects in this way. So and the way to think about it is, well, COVID happened, and we're doing a phase 3 trial. And in the phase 3 trial, we randomize people to salt water or Pfizer in their shoulder. And we would very much like to know what is the expected probability of getting a COVID infection in one arm versus another arm of the study. So if we're doing randomized trials, everything is great. And the standard kind of party line in causal inference is typically the questions we're asking in statistics outstrip our ability to conduct properly randomized trials, which means that the way treatment is assigned is not according to a randomization scheme the scientists came up with, but because of people's free will. And as soon as that happens, the observed outcomes are not quite the same as the outcomes that we're interested in, which is what would have happened if we were to set A to this or to this, like we would in a randomized trial. And so consequently, we want to see if we could. So this is how they think about it. They say, I would like to predict a hypothetical randomized trial without having access to randomized trial data. And to do that, I'm going to think in terms of these counterfactuals. Okay, that will tell me what would have happened in one arm or another one arm of a Pfizer phase 3 trial if I didn't actually run such a trial at all, but just let people take the shot if they want or not, basically. Okay, and so this yields this issue of identification in statistics, which is that does the observed data distribution actually have information about the parameter we care about? And in general, it does not, unsurprisingly. But with assumptions, maybe it does. And so the NPSEM, as I described it so far, does not have enough assumptions, typically, to get identification unless the graph is very simple. And so you place more assumptions than that to get somewhere. And we can talk about how realistic those are. OK, so now let's talk about the structural equation view. So in a DAG, we still have a DAG. And for every variable v, instead of talking about one step ahead counterfactuals, we'll talk about structural equations. And a structural equation is kind of causal mechanism. It's a function that takes the values of its parents in the graph and some extra noise term called epsilon or h or something. And they give you the output. So in this example, we have c, a, and y. And each of them has a function. The function for c only depends on the epsilon. The function for a depends on c and its epsilon. And the function for y on c and a and the epsilon. And remember that parents are conceptualized as direct causes. And the way this is cashed out here is direct causes are the things that go into your structural equations that are not epsilons, basically. And fv, again, describes the behavior of v in response to direct causes assuming particular values. So it's a very similar point of view, but it's described differently. It's described with mechanisms rather than random variables. And epsilon is needed because even if I specify all the direct causes, typically the way you want to do it, you can't specify them to such an extent that it becomes deterministic. So it's all the extraneous noise that still leaves it stochastic. OK. So in a structural equation view, the way you think about counterfactuals, or the due conditional, if you prefer, is by structural equation replacement. And the way you do that, if I want to intervene and I set a to little a, the way I do it is I look at my list of structural equations. I find the one for f of a. I get rid of it, and I put another one, f star, that basically is a trivial one that just outputs the constant a all the time. And in this graph, if I do that, I end up with an original c and a new structural equation, f star for this new variable a star that is now not really a variable anymore. It's more like a constant little a. And then you have y that is now a counterfactual y, because it now responds to how the structural equation would respond if a was always fixed to be little a. And sometimes people do versions of this graph to more directly represent this, where they, like what Pearl likes to do is what he calls mutilated graphs, where he deletes the arrow into a. There's also single world intervention graphs, which I didn't draw, but I can draw on the board if you're interested, to try to also represent this kind of thing directly. OK. So the structural equation view of the structural causal model is basically you have a bunch of functions, you have a bunch of epsilons, and you think about you think about all possible ways I could do interventions, and the distribution of the epsilons is unrestricted, so you don't place any assumptions in that. And the thing that I want to point out is that the potential outcome view and the structural equation view are really equivalent. The way I've presented it, they're just emphasizing different things. So the potential outcome view emphasizes the output. And the structural equation view emphasizes the mechanism. But it's the same thing. So you get the same description of the model in a slightly different way. OK. So the point is, both are useful to know. So sometimes it's more useful to think about causality with mechanisms, and sometimes it's more useful to think about causality with random variables, depending on what it is that you're doing. OK, so now a little nomenclature thing. So statisticians, when statisticians say model, what they mean is a set of distributions in a sample space. In set theory or model theory, when they say model, it's like a mathematical object you have a theory about. So for example, the piano arithmetic is a list of first order statements that hold about adding natural numbers and doing arithmetic in natural numbers. And a model, one model for it, is a mathematical object about which you could correspond what the statements are saying to some facts about this object. Like, that would be the natural numbers themselves. But also, there are other natural, like non-classical natural numbers that are other models of the piano arithmetic. So that's the way they use the word model. And so the thing to understand about reading people like Pearl is sometimes when they use the word model in his book, they don't mean model in a statistician sense. They mean something like a model theorist model. Yeah?
There are a lot of statisticians who also mean something like Pearl does. So
oh, yeah? So it's not even standard in statistics, you're saying?
Well-trained statisticians use it in that way, right? But
yeah.
Not so well-trained statisticians, people coming from other subjects, maybe, or many, many other people are using model as a single distribution.
Yeah, or like, yeah, I guess the way I was thinking is like it's a particular set of structured equations and epsilons. That's like what a model is. And then he talks about submodel, which is very confusing. Where when Pearl says submodel, what he means is you take a bunch of structured equations, you replace some of them with constants, and that's a submodel. To a statistician, a submodel is a subset. It's a set of distributions that are smaller. So anyways, I bring this up because part of the effort here is to build a glossary, so like when you read papers, you don't get super confused. And so this is important. People really use this word differently. And of course, physicists use it in a third way. Of course, why wouldn't they? Okay. Good. All right. So let's talk about interference. So in the standard view of statistics, you have individuals or experimental units, if you want to be impersonal, typically correspond to samples in your data frame. And typically, you assume that samples are independent, identically distributed from some observed data distribution. And the thing to understand about this assumption is it's a bit silly, especially with modern data, because a lot of modern data is from social networks or is about infectious disease or involves spatial proximity. And in all those cases, this assumption is violated because if I'm in a social network, I have network homophily. In other words, I'm similar to my friends. Consequently, me and my friends are not independent samples anymore. Consequently, IID is false. And with infectious disease, similarly, the whole point with vaccinating people is because of this, which is that if you vaccinate 80% of people, you get herd immunity. The other 20% people still have an effect of those vaccinations, even though they themselves never got it. So again, this is violation of IID because there is dependence across samples. So in causal inference, again, this is a glossary term. In causal inference, people think about dependence between samples as interference problems. Specifically, an interference is the case where somebody's treatment, the variable you intervene on, influences their outcome. And so this may or may not come up in physics. I'm guessing it might. So here's an example. There are two types of interference. The graphs on the top are realizations of households, like two roommates. And this Y1 and Y2 are their outcomes, like are they infected with COVID? And A1 and A2 are, did they get the vaccine or not? And the point is, you can't think of the roommates as independent samples in this problem because they live together. There will obviously be some sort of connection between them. And that connection is represented by this U. And so partial interference is when you have like a set of experimental units and some of them are correlated, but others are not. So in other words, if I think about pairs of roommates, I could think of different households as independent samples, roughly. But people within a household is not independent samples. So that's what's called partial interference. And of course, I drew the bell graph because it's funny. And like obviously, the example I had in mind is infectious disease, but it's clear that this might come up as also in bell type situations. Full interference is worse. Full interference is there is a big network. And you know, it's like 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, right? Like there's a very small diameter. You could hop from anyone to anyone else by very few hops, like which tends to be the case in social networks. And so the way to think about data from a big social network is there is just one sample because they're all marginally correlated somehow. Okay. And so then, you know, then you have a statistical problem with one sample and that's a bit weird, right? That's hard to do statistics like that. But in fact, a lot of data is like this. And so In doing an informal survey of machine learning people and statisticians, they tend to just ignore this, basically, and hope it goes away. Okay, so anyways, I just wanted to bring this up because I don't know if this came up before in discussions with quantum foundations and whether there's any analog of thinking about these kinds of things or not. Okay, another thing as far as reading papers, sometimes you will see something called sutva. This is like an older kind of Rubin school formulation of things. SUTVA stands for stable unit treatment value assumption. It's actually a two-part assumption. The first is consistency, which the way I've said it kind of follows from recursive substitution. But basically, it means that mechanisms are invariant to interventions. And the second is lack of interference. And the way this lack of interference manifests for Rubin or for people who do potential outcomes is the very fact that you were able to write YA already implies lack of interference. Because if there was interference, I wouldn't be able to just write a single A. I would have to index every counterfactual by the status of their roommate's treatment as well. So it wouldn't be like A, it would be A1, A2, or A3, or maybe the whole network, right? So the fact that I didn't do that already implies that it's well-defined to talk about just one person's treatment, okay? So it's a little bit invisible that that's happening, but this is technically an assumption. Just the fact, the act of writing Y of A is an assumption. Okay. And I'm sort of describing this interference stuff in terms of potential outcomes, because typically that's the view people have taken, but you could also do it in structural equation views because it's always possible. Okay, so there are two interpretations that you could adopt for exclusion restrictions, and you should read, there's a whole chapter in this Wick paper on this very thing. One of them, which follows from the way I've described it, is what's called individual level, which is that for every person, it is the case that their counterfactual is not a function of the Z. And another interpretation is distributional, if you're not willing to go that far, which basically says, if I look at the distribution of the counterfactual, it so happens that that distribution doesn't depend on Z, but that leaves open to the possibility that for some people it is, and for others it isn't, and it just so happens that at the distribution level, there is an independence. So these are different, and the first one is stronger because it says something for every person. So that's another sort of distinction people in causal make, a strong null or a strong effect versus a weak one, right? So strong null is like it's absent for everyone, and the weak one is, I don't know if it's actually called weak, it's just a regular one, I guess. It means it holds distributionally. Okay. And again, I encourage you to read this Wick paper where it discusses this in quite a bit and how to think about this graphically. Okay, so if I have a causal model of a DAG and I just write structural equations and I don't assume anything about epsilons, or alternatively, if I just use recursive substitution, then it's just an SCM or an NPSCM, and by itself, it's not very useful because it allows for the possibility that everything is confounded by a big epsilon, basically, because it doesn't say anything about epsilons. It doesn't say that they factorize or anything like that.
Yeah, just to clarify, if you go to 0.15?
Yeah.
When you talk about the distribution or population alone, can I interpret that as saying if I look at the joint distribution over multiple y of a counterfactuals, so they're not one step ahead, it's like y where a is equal to 0, y where a is equal to 1, and we're looking at a marginal on those counterfactual variables, which are not atomic,
yeah,
that marginal is independent of z. That's the...
I'm very careful to not talk about conflicting interventions in the way I'm describing it. So because we'll get to conflicting interventions in just a second, but some people think of them as a problem. So specifically, I say that for any little a and little z, it is a fact that it's not a function of z. So this is a marginal statement about just a single y for a particular kind of intervention. I'm not saying anything jointly here.
So how is that? Okay.
Because I'm making a statement on the margin, not on the joint, so it has to be a weaker statement, right?
Sorry, is that often stated as the expectation?
You could also do it in expectation. This is actually stronger than an expectation because it says the distribution is not a function.
Yeah.
It could be that the distribution is a function, but the expectation is not. Yeah so you could do that too.
The weakest one that's stated is the expectation.
Yeah, or some other moment. I mean, who knows, right? Yeah. But yeah, anyways, this all goes back to the fact that, you know, you could draw graphs and they kind of do, you know, graphs could mean what we want, right? Like folks who wrote this Wick paper would prefer that directed agents being missing represent individual level restrictions, but they also have a chapter where they discuss some other things you could be doing, where absences may maybe represent something like this. So again, there is no one interpretation of what DAG means. So that's, I think, an important takeaway here. Sorry, Ellie, I felt like you're still unhappy. Do you want to talk some more about this or take it offline? Okay, good. All right, so again, another important idea is, one DAG many models, right? So one thing you could do is you could essentially assume that the epsilons are all independent of each other. And if you translate that assumption into potential outcome language, you basically say that there are bags of variables, each variable is a some V given that I intervene on all the parents in various ways. And it's independent of any other such bag. And the reason that's true, if you make all the epsilons independent, is this variable V that I set to all the parents, the only source of randomness for it left is the epsilon. So epsilons being independent of each other implies this, these bags are independent of each other. So this is the model that Perl likes to work with. So Perl doesn't like the name NPSEMIE. So he says, why don't you just say structural causal model? And I think the reason I make it explicit is because I just want to be explicit that there is this extra assumption, the IE assumption, that the epsilons are independent. Because you know, I mean, it is still a structural causal model technically, it's just with more assumptions. And I think it's just important to indicate that they're being made. Because people are not always careful about this. Sometimes they say, well, all the epsilons are independent, and sometimes they say, oh, some epsilons are independent and other epsilons are not, and so there is a bidirected arc, and that's still a structural causal model. And I think that's confusing. I think it's just important to indicate what exactly it is that you're assuming. Okay, so then there is this other model, and this model only takes care to assume independences if there is a consistent interventional assignment to everything. So you first figure out some set of values for everything. That's going to be what you intervene on things on. And then you say that any variable under that where you set the parents to the appropriate subset of that assignment is independent of any other variable under that same subset for their parents. I'm going to give you an example in a second. But this is technically, it's a larger model, weaker assumption. FFRCSTG is a terrible name that Jamie Robbins came up with. And the reason he came up with this name is because he had a paper on the healthy worker survivor effect in 1986, where he basically invented a lot of modern causal inference there, including, he didn't do it with graphs. He did it with something called structure tree graphs, which aren't graphical models. They're like branching event trees. And so he had this whole way of thinking about it, where this is a special case of it, that later turned out to have a graphical interpretation. So that's where the name comes from. But basically, I think of the NPSEMIE with independent epsilons as like a multiple worlds model, because it's making multiple world statements. I'll get to that in a second. And the FFRCSTG is a single world model, because it only makes statements of independence between a single consistent interventional world. So here is an example of how these two models differ. So the FFRCSTG basically says that for any assignment A and C that I fix once and for all, these variables A of C and Y of A of C are independent of each other. What Perl's model says is something a little stronger. It says that C and A of C and A of C prime is also independent, even if C and C prime disagree with each other. And so the first model doesn't say that. It only says that they're independent if C's agree. Okay, is that clear what the difference is? So clearly the second bullet point is more assumptions, because you iterate over more value combinations. Okay, now Perl would say, well, look, it's all just mechanisms and epsilons, so it's very reasonable to assume that epsilons are independent, in which case this would be implied. And people like Jamie Robbins and Thomas Richardson would say, well, yes, but your way of thinking effectively assumes something like this that doesn't submit itself to any kind of empirical test, because to check if this holds, you need to somehow figure out how for a single person to simultaneously give them little c and little c prime. And that's not the kind of thing you can do without a time machine. And so it's not clear what it is that this model is even doing. It doesn't admit falsification usually. I mean, there are some designs where it can, like washout designs in some cases, but in general not. And so the thought is this is kind of not scientific. So that's the criticism of that approach. So Perl's think of this like an electrical engineer where it's circuits and epsilons. And you know, Thomas and Jamie, my interpretation of what they're thinking about it is they think about it like scientists in a Popperian framework, right? They want to be able to falsify things they're assuming. Okay. So there is a lot of ink spilled about this. Just one second. Let me just finish with this thought here. So I'm going to leave it aside. I'm not going to take sides here. But the important thing to take away here is there is one graph and different models here. These models imply slightly different things. And I think it's important to get clear on what model it is you want to assume for what you're doing. Go ahead.
Yeah, so the point you're making there seems really important about related to this meeting, right, about the fact that some observables can't be jointly measured, right? Doesn't that also apply to...
Not only can't be jointly exist, which is stronger than it cannot be jointly measured.
Sure, yeah. Doesn't that apply to the first two in both cases, the capital C and the A of little c?
can I take this offline? So they have a story of how that could be made to exist. Like, you know, they have these stories, I'm giving you a pill, but right as if I give it to you, I catch it, and something like that. So there are ways of, this is not quite cross-world in the same sense, basically, is my answer. But I think maybe we should take it offline. Okay, so another glossary thing is cross-world assumption. A cross-world assumption is one that is talking about a joint distribution where there isn't a consistent interventional assignment. And there are folks in like public health and statistics who find that problematic because it's, they think it's not a subject to an empirical test, basically, the way we usually think of interventions. Okay, and then one of the things about these two models is they do agree on identifiability. Remember, we're interested in using observed data to see, to predict what would happen in hypothetical experiments. And it turns out that if I have a DAG and everything is fully observed, except for these epsilons, and the epsilons are all independent, either in the first way or the second way, then we get identification of everything we like. And this identification is given by the G formula. So the formula itself is up here, and here are some examples. And so the way this formula works is anytime the variable you intervene on is mentioned after the conditioning bar, you set it to the value you intervene on. And if it occurs before the conditioning bar, you leave it alone. And then you sum out what you don't care about. Actually, this is called the extended G formula. But what ends up happening, there are some important special cases. So for example, if I want to intervene on little a, and I look at y as the outcome in this graph, and I only care about y as the outcome, I end up marginalizing a and c, and I get something called this, which is the adjustment formula, also called stratification, also called lots of other things because it's important. And this is what adjusting for confounders refers to. It's just a special case of the G formula. The other thing to think about here is that if I do the empty set of interventions, then I don't do anything, and I just end up with a DAG factorization. And what that means is that another way to think about the distinction between a causal and a statistical model of a DAG is that causal DAGs imply statistical DAGs. Okay, and it's almost 3 o'clock, so I kind of have to stop soon, right? Okay, so I have this whole other part of the talk that I have no time for, but basically that's about hidden variables.
We do have a building coffee break, so if you want like 5 minutes pushing in it.
No, it's fine. It's like, come on, it's like 15 slides, so I think, and it's like the hard 15 slides. So let me get to the very end. This is this is just margins to GNTN stuff, basically. So, okay. So what should we think about? So I'm just thinking about what we can do to accelerate progress. And I think one thing that I'm really interested in is glossary of terms. So there's a bunch of technical terms in causal, such as, I've mentioned some of them, such as interference, consistency, exclusion restrictions, faithfulness, came up a few times, and many, many others. And there are these things in physics, like signaling and things like that, that seem to correspond to some of these in ways that I don't fully understand. And I think to better read papers, I think it would be great if some sort of joint effort were to take place that would try to go back and forth. There seem to be a bunch of problems of common interest, such as model selection compatibility, model descriptions, and factorizations. I think these have been described already. Maybe others. One big interesting problem for us causal people is what happens if the effects are not identified, but you could maybe put bounds on them, because bounds could be informative. And that seems to be closely related to inequalities that you get. So that might be a fun thing for us to think about together. I'm curious if there are any tips on how we can read each other's papers easily, because I certainly have a hard time with physics papers. I'm hoping to make progress at this event. And the part of this talk that I skipped is not a secret. I'm happy to go through it with people at some other time. Thank you.
Any questions? Any questions from people online? Just speak up.
I'm afraid to put up the Zoom because it's going to go recursive on me. Recursive substitution. The Zoom. Yes.
Will be recursively substituted.
Maybe I can ask something. Not exactly related to the talk, but you did touch it a little bit. You represented latent variable side. And I think you know that because I heard from you in the past that you know the answer to this, so that's why I'm asking. Can you talk about the generality of semi-Markovian versus non-Markovian?
I think I don't know if Yuda is incredibly precise what he means by what semi-Markovian models are. My understanding is, you know, like, so usually the way they're drawn is with bidirected arcs. And usually what he means by that is some epsilons are not independent anymore. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. So in the interference slides, you showed, for example, to be concrete, right? In the interference slides, you had latents between pairs of rooms, but not jointly.
Like this?
Yes.
So well, you mean like the first set of figures on top, right?
So my question is, how do we know the second one is the full general? Right? Because if I could have a U that points to everything versus, that's what I'm asking.
Oh, that's an easy question. So if you had data on the below graph, well, what I'm actually illustrating here is the fact that I could have a single sample and then you can't do anything. But let's say I had many realizations of this graph. And if I don't see stuff in red, but I see stuff in black, then that's great because there's a bunch of marginal independences I could check. So this is related to the problem of learning max. And this is a mag. This is an ancestral graph. Or rather, if I represent this, I mean, I didn't talk about this because I had to skip it. Like, if I represent this hidden variable DAG by latent projection, where I replace U's by bidirected edges, what I will find is I will get a mag. And then not only that, I will get a mag with a bunch of constraints that I could use data to check. And I could, in fact, I think in this case, I could learn a very informative equivalence class for this. I think the thing that I will not be able to learn is whether the edges from the A's to the Y's are directed or bidirected. But other than that, I'll be able to see that this is the structure.
So I think I remember you saying at some point in some medium that representing latents, that just using latents that points to exactly two variables, two observed variables, is very generic. Is that correct? That's what I'm...
Oh, I think you might be talking about something Robin said in Slack, where there is a, if I start with a latent projection, if I start with a graph with a bidirected edges, it's possible to represent them by something called a canonical DAG, where I replace, is that what you mean? Like you replace bidirected edges by a certain kind of U. And there is a sense in which that's without loss of generality.
Related, I think, yeah.
Okay, so what are you asking me? I mean, yeah, that's true. I mean, Robin's right. okay. I mean, there is. I could dig up the specific reference where this is shown if you're curious.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's in one of his papers. Yeah.
Well, I don't know where. I mean, this is probably a question which is too difficult for a show, but it's rather common. It's this whole idea about a cross world and not cross world assumption.
Yeah.
This is very much related to the standing conflict between interpretations of probability as Kolmogorov did it or Definetti did it, or interpretation of statistical variation as Neyman did it or Fisher did it. And they were sort of, I mean, they were not friends with each other.
That's not surprising, knowing Fisher.
It's somehow related to the general quantum world as well, because it's a question of whether these things do not exist simultaneously. In the Neyman stuff or in the Kolmogorov probability, there is one latent variable omega which runs the world.
Right.
Everything is a deterministic function of it. Right. Whereas in the Definetti or Fisher approach, if you like, although Fisher was not necessarily a subjectivist, but in their approach, it's a random variable. It's not a function of something as this is. A random variable is just something that is an abstraction, and suddenly, if you can measure it, and when you measure it, it changes status. It's a bit much more closer to the quantum way of thinking than the original way of thinking.
Yeah, one of the things I want to understand better is this whole. I think what you're talking about is counterfactual definiteness, like all the potential outcomes exist or something. I mean that's part of the glossary effort. I want to see if that's what it means, basically.
Yeah, and it also exists. And even you can talk about the joint distribution, and you get these.
Yeah.
And now certain things are sort of innocent in the sense that if you take y1 or y2 and you take the expectation of the difference, it
yep.
only depends on the marginals, y0 and y1, which you can observe. But if you take the expectation of the ratio, it depends on the joint distribution of y1 and y0, which simply, not only can you not measure it, it doesn't exist. It's
right. Right, it's undefined. It's undefined to talk about it, yeah.
And the point is, in the Kolmogorov, or if you like, Neyman probability world, the fact that things do not exist simultaneously is not an issue. because they can still be well defined by this function, right?
Just to be clear, I'm going to give my interpretation of what people's positions are, so I may not be entirely right. So the authors of the SWIG paper are large ontology people. What I mean by that is they think it's fine. Like, this all exists for them.
Yeah.
So they're not, it's just that they don't want to make assumptions on this joint. Like, they only want to make single world assumptions for some Popperian reasons or something. Now, there are people like Phil who don't think this joint exists.
Yes.
And in fact, they don't like this whole counterfactual notation at all. So they're small ontology people. There's a big argument about this.
And it's sort of the same argument as in the truth, can things be explained by latent variables and deterministic relationships?
Mm-hmm.
Where, some people use the word causal when they mean deterministic.
Right.
This is something I wouldn't dare say here, but I had the impression that the Bohr-Einstein discussion is about that as well, right?
Yeah, I suppose. I'm probably not the person to ask about this, but there are people in this room who know better. Yeah,
would know about that.
But, yeah.
There's something hidden in all these controversies that sits quite deeply.
Yeah.
And it's not just a sort of a technical device.
I agree. This is kind of why I decided to include this slide, because I think it might be relevant, basically. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.